From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And today in New York, what's called the first day of debate began at the UN General Assembly. President Trump's address was not the first, but it was maybe the most anticipated. And he delivered an expected message telling world leaders assembled that the U.S. would not be constrained by other nations.
I honor the right of every nation in this room to pursue its own customs, beliefs, and traditions. The United States will not tell you how to live or work or worship. We only ask that you honor our sovereignty in return.
NPR's diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman is also in New York. Michelle, there you hear the theme promised by Ambassador Nikki Haley, sovereignty. But overall, how would you characterize the tone of the speech, especially compared to last year when the president called Kim Jong-un rocket man and said he'd pull out of multilateral agreements?
Well, he's delivered on some of the pulling out of agreements. I mean, since last year, the U.S. pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal. He pulled out of the U.N. Human Rights Council. Mm-hmm. He's not taking part in the Global Compact on Migration. And his administration is threatening to undercut the International Criminal Court now. Mm-hmm. And so what you heard from him today was this very strong message about sovereignty, as you said. America is governed by Americans, and we reject the ideology of globalism, he said, and embrace the doctrine of patriotism. So it was a message to the UN that, our interests are above anything else that you guys might be interested
in. We had been reading in the run-up to this that some of his aides who are in favor of everything you just listed were afraid that he might soften his message a bit. You know, that thing that President Trump seems to have, which is a need to be liked as well.
Well, yeah, but it didn't. He didn't soften his message, at least on that sort of thing. But it was interesting, even when he's lashing out at Iran this time, he also said in a tweet that he's not going to meet with Iran's leader, though he suspects he might be a very nice man or something along those lines.
Well, I want to ask you about that, but there was one moment that jumped out, because normally these speeches are about global goals, and the president's at times veered to almost a defensive campaign trail speech. And this is a very sober gathering, prime ministers, presidents. But at one point, President Trump drew an unintended laugh.
In less than 2 years, my administration has accomplished more than almost any administration in the history of our country. America's so true. Didn't expect that reaction, but that's okay.
You might have been thinking, oh, I don't know, FDR maybe had some more accomplishments. But was a moment like that endearing? I mean, how did that go over?
I'm not sure how he'll take it. That's the problem, because, he usually likes this big forum of speaking to world leaders, and having people laugh at him may not have been the best outcome for him. But, he did... He did make light of it. I think it was mostly that he comes in to talk to this world body, and it sounds like kind of a campaign rally,
right?
That he, kind of the language that he uses at those sort of rallies.
Well, but there were other things, the idea of fairness, which is one of his themes, that the U.S. is the world's biggest donor of foreign aid. Countries who receive it need to give something back. He hinted Secretary of State Mike Pompeo will be doing a comprehensive review of U.S. aid. Do you expect a big policy change there?
Well, they have been talking about cutting aid, and they have been cutting aid. They're looking at decreasing the amount, the percentage of the U.S. payments to the U.N. peacekeeping, which is the big budget item over here. They're also cutting all aid to Palestinians, including to the U.N. agency that helps Palestinians. They've promised to cut more, and that's what they're going to go through. And they say that they want to only spend money on countries that support their values.
Let's take a minute and listen to U.N. Secretary General Antonio Guterres, who sounded a different tone. Let's listen.
Our world is suffering from a bad case of trust deficit disorder.
Trust deficit disorder, this idea that this is a body that was formed to trust, to try to bring trust among nations and work together. And here's somebody who's talking against that very theme.
Yeah, I mean, and a lot of speakers have been raising that. You know, you just had the French president, Emmanuel Macron, making that same case, this need for multilateralism, dealing with the world's problems, dealing with things like climate change. Guterres spent a lot of time talking about that. I mean, also the issue of migration. Guterres, before he became Secretary General, he headed the UN Refugee Agency, and he says he's very worried about discrimination and demagoguery against refugees, that we need multilateralism now more than ever. But, you know, President Trump, in his address, defended his decisions to cut down the number of refugees that the U.S. is taking in. And he also said the way to deal with migration is for other countries to make their countries great again so people won't have to leave.
Michelle, just got a couple seconds, but the president is touting his success in North Korean talks. Others are saying nothing has really happened. Do you get the sense that he's hoping to have the same result the way he views North Korea with Iran?
Probably, but not quite yet. I mean, there's no plans to have any meetings on the sidelines, whereas they're going for a second summit with North Korea without any real concrete denuclearization plans in the works yet.
It's NPR's Michelle Kellerman in New York. Michelle, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, as we continue to follow the destruction from Hurricane Florence, we've also been hearing a lot about the devastation on Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria, which hit 1 year ago. Many Puerto Ricans have fled the island, which was already in the midst of an economic catastrophe when Maria struck. But Simone Rios from member station WBUR visited the island and found some Puerto Ricans who want to stay.
At a makeshift car wash on the side of the road on the outskirts of San Juan, three young men spray down a beaming black Acura. This car wash didn't exist before the hurricane. It's one of many realities people on the island describe as before Maria or after Maria.
My name is Angel Rosario, and I live in Bravos de Boston Cantera.
Rosario spent much of his childhood in Springfield, Massachusetts. In the wake of Hurricane Hugo, he moved in with his grandmother in the late 1980s. And like all Puerto Ricans who are U.S. citizens, Rosario had the chance to return to Springfield when Hurricane Maria struck.
But I decided to stay here. 7 months without energy. Nobody came, no government help. The help came from all the people, all the neighbors. We help each other, talking, buying things with our own money, because nobody came here to help us.
But he says worse than having no power was having no job. Rosario says before the hurricane, he was the director of athletics for the Public Housing Authority in San Juan. He and many of his neighbors lost their jobs after the storm, and he says many left the neighborhood to look for better conditions in places like Massachusetts.
In this house that she left, the one from the second floor, Aida left two, like one, two, three, six families from this street.
Just in this little street right here?
Just in this street.
Canito Contreras is among those who stayed. He got the maximum amount of disaster money from FEMA, $33,300, and he's using it to rebuild a house that was devastated by the storm. Contreras says it was painful to see his house destroyed, but now, with the help of one of his sons, he hopes to be finished in time for Christmas. Of the 13 children he raised in his house, Contreras says nearly all of them have left for the mainland. Living without light, with mosquitoes, the smell of gas burning in old generators, it was too much, especially for the ones with kids of their own. Outside the gleaming white Puerto Rico Convention Center in San Juan, a row of riot police stand guard. The island's fiscal control board is having one of its regular meetings, and there's been rumors a protest could break out. Inside the building, economist José Caraballo Cueto tells me why people are upset with the organization set up to manage the finances of the Puerto Rican state.
There is a lot of people that is not happy with the imposition of the fiscal control board, and more than imposition, the policies that they're taking, the austerity. After Hurricane Maria, they're giving more money to bondholders than to social expenditures in the islands.
Caraballo Cueto heads the Census Information Center at the University of Puerto Rico in Calle. He describes Puerto Rico as being in the midst of a Great Depression and says many were already leaving in the years leading up to the storm. Federal data show 179,000 more fled after the hurricane. Many have returned, but Caraballo Cueto estimates 77,000 have not. He says those people staying on the mainland are exactly the young people Puerto Rico needs to help with the reconstruction.
Most of the people that are migrating from the beginning of this Great Depression are young people, and thus is causing an increase in the percentage of elder population in the island. Right now, Puerto Rico is the oldest country in the Americas.
Now the big question for Caraballo Cueto and many others in Puerto Rico is what happens with the tens of billions in disaster money set to roll in. He says if it's spent wisely, it could create long-term employment for Puerto Ricans who want to stay. That way, more people like Anito Contreras can contribute to the reconstruction. He says in spite of it all, he still feels positive. And after all, he says he owes it to his daughter, who has a severe disability, to rebuild their lives on the island they call home. For Here and Now, I'm Simon Rios in San Juan.
White House spokesperson Sarah Sanders was asked today whether President Trump has confidence in Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein. Here's what Sanders had to say to George Stephanopoulos on ABC's Good Morning America.
The president has confidence in the system, and he...
That's not what I asked.
I'm not going to get ahead of the conversation that's going to take place.
That conversation will take place on Thursday between President Trump and Rosenstein after reports yesterday that Rosenstein may be out of a job after that New York Times story Friday that he discussed invoking the 25th Amendment to have President Trump removed. Rosenstein has denied that story in the Times. Meanwhile, President Trump's lawyer Jay Sekulow said on his radio show yesterday that if Rosenstein leaves, the Mueller investigation that he oversees should be put on hold.
I think it's really important that there be a step back taken here and a review. And I think it's a review that has to be thorough and complete, and a review that has to include an investigation of what has transpired with all of these statements and all of these allegations going back to the Strachan page and Bruce Orr, and basically a timeout on this inquiry.
James Clapper, the former director of national intelligence, disagreed with Sekulow. Here's what he told CNN yesterday.
I'm kind of not surprised that one of the president's attorneys would suggest that we have a, quote, timeout, which I'm sure at a minimum would extend through the midterm elections.
So as Rosenstein's fate hangs in the air this week, there is another debate in the legal community over what special counsel Robert Mueller is going to do with all the information he's gathering. He's said to be working on a report about his investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election and potential involvement of the Trump campaign. Well, now three legal experts are petitioning the district court in D.C. to release a Watergate-era document that they say could be helpful to Mueller. Benjamin Wittes is one of those behind the petition. He's senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He is editor-in-chief at Lawfare. Benjamin, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with your petition. You are asking for what's called the Watergate Roadmap to be released. It has been sealed at the National Archives. What is it?
The Roadmap is a document that Special Prosecutor Leon Jaworski put together in 1974 and sent to the House Judiciary Committee, which was considering the impeachment of Richard Nixon. And the roadmap contained 55 pages of a kind of skeletal sketch of the evidence that Jaworski had put together that suggested that the president may have committed impeachable offenses. And it was designed to share with the House Judiciary Committee the evidence that Jaworski had put together that they might need in the course of their constitutional responsibilities to consider impeachment questions.
And why do you think it's important for Mueller to see it?
Well, so Mueller himself will decide whether it's important to see it. The document is still sealed because it contains grand jury material, and grand jury material is, unless a judge intervenes, sealed forever. And so the document is not available to the public, including Mueller. And when Ken Starr in the late 1990s had to write an impeachment referral, one of the staffers who was working on it, who is one of the co-petitioners on this, Stephen Bates, went to the National Archive and asked to see this document because it was the principal model document that was available to what they were trying to do, and the National Archives wouldn't let him see it. Hmm. Our hypothesis is that this is one possible model that's available to Mueller as he contemplates writing this report, whatever the report that he's writing is. And he's not allowed to see it. And by the way, neither are any of the people in the press or in the broader legal community who might have opinions about what sort of report is appropriate for him to submit.
How different is it from the Starr report?
It's by all accounts, it is quite different. So while we don't have the document itself, it has been described by a number of sources, including Jaworski himself in his memoir and another memoir of one of his staffers. And so we have a sense of what the document looks like, which is to say that it's very skeletal. It does not contain legal argumentation or conclusions. It does not tell a narrative. It simply provides evidence. And that, you know, the Starr report, which remains controversial to this day, took a very different approach. Starr wrote a very detailed narrative, which went on for, you know, hundreds of pages. And he also wrote a very detailed set of analytic conclusions about whether the president had committed impeachable offenses. And so this is a document that is much, you know, less argumentative and less involved. So it's a very different model in some ways than the Starr report.
When it comes to the Mueller investigation, there are legal constraints that he has to deal with if he intends to send information to Congress. What does the law say about what Mueller can send to Congress?
Well, the law doesn't say very much. The independent counsel statute under which Starr was serving, which had a provision that specifically required the provision to Congress of impeachment material, that law no longer exists. And so Mueller is serving under a regulation that is much closer to the regulation that Jaworski served under than to the rules under which Ken Starr served. And that, I think, makes the way Jaworski handled this a particularly interesting question because, you know, Mueller doesn't have the benefit of the Starr example. He can't follow the Starr example quite as easily, but the Jaworski model is very much available to him.
By the way, the independent counsel statute that you're talking about that no longer exists was allowed to lapse because in part of the testimony of Deputy Attorney General Eric Holder at the time. This is in the Clinton administration back in the late 90s. He was against that statute existing.
As was Ken Starr, who served under it. And, you know, by the time the independent counsel law lapsed, almost everybody favored its lapsing. On the other hand, the lapsing of the statute did create this hole because the statute gave guidance as to what somebody was supposed to do in this situation. And the current reg that replaced it doesn't really answer the question. It provides for the special counsel to write a final report that is given to the deputy attorney general or the attorney general when he's not recused. But it does not provide for an answer to the question of what, if any, interim report may be appropriate in a circumstance in which he may have uncovered evidence of impeachable offenses, or in the case in which there is, as there appears to be here, a spin-off investigation that may finish before the larger investigation or the set of, so here, by all accounts, there's sort of a separate obstruction of justice investigation that may wrap up long before the broader investigation of Russian interference in the 2016 campaign. And it's not entirely clear from the regulation how a special counsel is supposed to handle that situation.
So do you think that you and others will be successful and that the Watergate roadmap will be unsealed?
So I certainly hope so. And, you know, I think both for historical reasons and for contemporary reasons, it is a document that really should be public. You know, the traditional reason that we keep grand jury material secret
is to protect witnesses and also, you know, to protect people's privacy. And in this case, almost all the material in the document, by all accounts, has become public already. So there's not substantive material that is not public. And we're really interested in the form and structure and mode of the document. And in addition, the witnesses and people named in the report are mostly all deceased at this point, and at least one of those who is not has, you know, explicitly said he has no objection to the roadmap becoming public. So I think the privacy arguments for keeping it secret are very weak at this point, and the public interest in it is very strong.
President Trump has called the Mueller investigation a witch hunt. Do you think, as somebody who's trying to unseal this old document, do you think that anything will come of the Mueller investigation?
So, you know, I don't know the answer to that question. And I, unlike the president, I believe that the integrity of investigations asks us all to reserve judgment on them. I think this is a very serious investigation that has produced already very serious investigative outcomes. And I have high regard for Bob Mueller and his staff and want to create the space for them to do their jobs and answer the questions before them without prejudging that or saying what the answers should be. And the president shouldn't be doing that. And I shouldn't be doing it either. So I'm not going to.
That's Benjamin Wittes, who is senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and editor-in-chief at Lawfare. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Environmental issues don't usually rank high among voters' concerns in polling, and they're generally more associated with Democrats than Republicans. But as the midterm election approaches, Republican lawmakers in swing districts outside Philadelphia are spending a lot of time talking about water pollution. NPR's Jeff Brady reports.
People who live near a military base north of Philadelphia are learning their drinking water contains pollution from a group of chemicals called PFAS. A firefighting foam used at the base contains the chemicals, which are linked to illnesses, including cancer.
It's not healthy to have fire foam and other things in your drinking water.
Even though authorities now say the water is safe to drink, Pam Miranda says she filters all the water that comes into her home. Down the street, George Snyder says he uses bottled water.
I buy spring water, and I'm very conscientious about that. I even give the spring water to my animals, my dogs and cat.
With people on the street worried about this pollution, Republican State Representative Tom Mert introduced legislation to reduce the amount of PFAS contamination allowed in drinking water. His bill would require levels even lower than what the Environmental Protection Agency advises. The legislation likely won't pass this year in Pennsylvania, but it sends a message to constituents that he cares about this environmental issue, and Mert has no problem criticizing the Trump administration's EPA.
This is a problem that was caused by the federal government, and they are woefully slow, woefully inadequate in addressing this right now.
The EPA is working on a plan to manage PFAS chemicals, but not fast enough for critics like Congressman Brian Fitzpatrick. He's another Republican in the Philly suburbs who faces a challenging re-election. This summer, Fitzpatrick called on then-EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt to resign over handling of the PFAS issue. Pruitt did resign a few weeks later as ethics and management scandals piled up. The point here is that Republicans like Fitzpatrick and Mert have been some of the most vocal critics of the Trump administration's response to the PFAS pollution issue. And in Mert's case, his Democratic challenger has noticed.
Hello there.
Daryl Bolling spends evenings and weekends these days campaigning door to door, where he says the PFAS issue comes up often. He takes that as an opportunity to criticize his Republican opponent.
I feel like there's so much more that could have been done, and it's only really being aggressively addressed because of the fact that there is an uprising, that there is a mass of concern out there that it's making clear in an election year that this is something that has to be dealt with.
Bolling says Mert is being reactive when he should have been proactive. As you might guess, Mert disagrees.
We have been out in front of this issue for years now, and if anybody is being reactive, it would be my opponent.
Muhlenberg College political science professor Chris Borick says in this election year, Republicans like Mert and Fitzpatrick would much rather talk about environmental issues than fellow Republican President Trump, who is unpopular here.
They are looking for ways to try and make it clear that they're willing to work with Democrats. They're willing to bump up against the Trump administration's Environmental Protection Agency and demonstrate that they're interested in solving these problems.
And it's not just here in suburban Philadelphia. At a recent congressional hearing, Republicans were among those pressing the EPA to address the PFAS issue more quickly. The agency says it's working on its management plan and will release it later this year, after the election. Jeff Brady, NPR News, Philadelphia.
Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh is strongly denying allegations of sexual assault against him while in high school or college. But a lot of the conversation since those allegations came to light has been about how that drunken behavior, described as holding a hand over a girl's mouth while trying to undress her, or exposing oneself and forcing a man part in a woman's face, is just what boys do. Conservative commentator Stephen Miller tweeted out, "This isn't sexual assault. It's drunk teenagers playing 7 minutes in heaven." Gina Sosa, a Republican Trump supporter, said this on CNN.
We're talking about a 17-year-old boy in high school with testosterone running high. Tell me what boy hasn't done this in high school. Please, I would like to know.
In other words, boys will be boys. But what message does that send to girls who might be assaulted today? And what does it say about boys? One college course asked young men to say what a good man was. They said caring and kind, but a real man? They said he was a risk taker, a rule breaker. Cliff Leek is a professor of sociology at the University of Northern Colorado, also the president of the National Association of Men's Studies. Yes, it's a recent thing. He joins us by Skype. Professor, what's been your thinking as you've heard this national dialogue?
Yeah, so this national dialogue around this phrase, boys will be boys, and using that to excuse negative behavior from boys and young men is certainly not something new. But what I've always found interesting about it is that we never use the phrase boys will be boys to discuss positive things that boys do. It's almost exclusively used to write off or explain away when boys misbehave. So it's actually reinforcing the idea that that sort of misbehavior, including serious offenses, are what we should expect from boys. And to even take it a step further, it almost frames it as if to imply that those behaviors are actually what make boys boys.
There is a confusion about what a real man and a good man is.
Right. And I think that that's a justifiable confusion given the way that we raise young boys and men. So for example, I did an activity in my sociology of gender class just yesterday where I asked my students to tell me stories about the best men that they know. And we created a whole list of traits that describe those men. We got, honest, caring, fatherly, all that sort of thing, right? And then I asked students, when we hear things like be a man or grow a pair or man up, what sort of behaviors are we trying to get boys to engage in? And it's never the same things that we get on the list of what makes a good man. It's always to shut down boys' emotions, to get them to take unhealthy risks. even though we have this ideal of what makes a good man, the sorts of things and behaviors that we reinforce as manly to boys are not what we expect from good men.
Well, and then this, you know, boys will be boys. This is just what people do. Even Judge Kavanaugh said in his interview on Fox last night, you know, everybody drank in high school. Everybody, you know, got out of control in high school with drinking. I'm paraphrasing, of course. He went on to say, but these are allegations of sexual assault, and again, denied them. But even there, I've been hearing from young people and older men saying, please, you know, not everybody does that.
Yeah, absolutely. This idea that everybody engages in this, it's the parallel to the boys will be boys language, right? If we say that everybody engages in it, then what we actually do is we take the majority of people who don't engage in it and make them into the outcasts. This language of everybody engages in it is really just a way of trying to normalize one's own negative behavior and somehow make everybody else seem like they're the ones that aren't normal and they're the ones that aren't okay.
Well, and just to underscore this, the name Mark Judge has come up quite a bit. He was a classmate of Brett Kavanaugh's at Georgetown Preparatory School. Christine Blasey Ford, who alleges that she was attacked by Kavanaugh in a bedroom at a party, he was very drunk, said that Mark Judge was laughing maniacally while it was going on. He's gone on to be somebody, a writer, who's actually celebrated the drunken life that he had in high school. His memoir was Wasted Tales of a Gen X Drunk. It features a character, Bart O'Kavanaugh, who passes out on his way back from a party. The quote he chose for his high school yearbook page was, certain women should be struck regularly like a gong. And then there is that high school yearbook on Brett Kavanaugh's page. He writes about a pledge of 100 kegs or bust. And he's one of several young men who talk about a woman named Renata. There's a group photo of football players. They call themselves the Renata alumni. Kavanaugh's in that picture. He also has that on his own personal page. Reportedly a reference to a young woman, Renata Schroeder, who was a student at a nearby Catholic girls' school. And another man who was at the school at the same time, Sean Hagan, says, I can't express how disgusted I am with them then and now. He claims it was an insinuation by all of these football players on their pages in the yearbook that they had made a conquest of this woman. She's now released a statement saying how hurt and horrified she is by this. This kind of stuff was endorsed by adults. It's there in a yearbook.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And what's fascinating about not just these elite private all-male schools, but also all-male spaces in general, they tend to emphasize a sense of brotherhood. And that brotherhood is sometimes explicitly, but usually implicitly, at the exclusion and expense of girls and women. And oftentimes those bonds between men are forged over things like the conquest of women.
Well, but okay, you talk about these all-male spaces like teams, but again, doesn't it also not only paint all men and all boys with the same brush, that so that, you know, as one teen said to me, you know, people are looking at me like I do this, I don't do this, mm-hmm. but it also demeans them. It tells men and young boys, we don't have the confidence in you to behave differently.
Yes, absolutely. So there's numerous men out there that for whom this boys will be boys mentality doesn't resonate, for whom our traditional ideas of what masculinity is and what men are supposed to be like doesn't resonate, right? And we send those boys the message that they aren't real boys or they aren't real men because they aren't conforming with those ideas. And we apply all sorts of social pressures to try to encourage boys to conform with those ideas, whether that be bullying or harassment or telling them to man up or grow a pair. These are all ways that we socially try to encourage boys to conform to that, even when it doesn't resonate with so many of us. I would say that there's really two major challenges that face all of us boys who for whom this doesn't resonate. The first challenge is being introspective to recognize when and how our own behaviors conform to these ideas, when and how our own behaviors harm others, and recognize where we can make changes in our own lives. Challenge number two, what I would say that we face is the challenge to not be complicit, to not see these things happening around us and be silent. So our silence can be taken as support or assent for these sorts of behaviors. So it's really important for us to speak out and not be bystanders, right? So when we see these things that we recognize as problematic and we recognize, you know, as the man who went to school with Kavanaugh said, you know, I was disgusted by those behaviors then and now. That's a challenge that I think we all face, all of us men who are in these positions, is to do something about it in the moment.
You know, how do you do that? Say mm-hmm. you're sitting down at the dinner table with your kids tonight. Let's say maybe you did have behavior in high school and college you're not proud of now. Do you own it and say that? Do you admit to doing it in order to tell your kids not to?
I would say that, yes, that's exactly what we do. I will come out and say, you know, I did have moments in high school, and I went to an elite private all-boys school, much like Kavanaugh did. And I did have moments in my career in high school where I made choices that I'm not proud of. And I've done what I can to try to make amends for that. And I think that that's exactly the conversation that we need to be having with young boys and young men.
Well, you know, I also think, judging from a reaction I got at the gym this morning from many older men, maybe also saying, I didn't do that. And it doesn't happen everywhere.
Yes. I think that we've all engaged in things that we weren't proud of in our youth, right? But it's not all to the extent that what we're hearing about Judge Kavanaugh. So I think we can all own up to the ways, big and small, where we have engaged in this behavior. But in terms of doing things like the sexual assault that Judge Kavanaugh is accused of, we should absolutely stand firm and say, no, not everyone did engage in that. And that is extreme and that is unacceptable. Yeah.
Professor Cliff Leek, he teaches sociology at the University of Northern Colorado. His upcoming book is Boy, Oh Boy, which reimagines what boys will be boys means by highlighting men who behave outside the confines of these stereotypes that really seem to be not freeing for men, but prisons for them. Professor Leek, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And by the way, if you're a boy of color not at an elite school, you'd be in jail.
Yes, abso-frickin-lutely. You know, what happens at my high school stays at my high school. That doesn't apply to folks who aren't at elite prep schools. Yeah. I can't imagine any of my students who are students of color getting away with saying what happens at my high school stays at my high school.
Yeah. Professor, thank you.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Democrats will have to pick up 23 seats to retake the House of Representatives this November. And this week for our district profile, we're looking at one race that may go from red to blue. In Iowa's 1st Congressional District, Democrat Abby Finkenauer is challenging incumbent Republican Congressman Rod Blum. O.K. Henderson is news director at Radio Iowa. She joins us from Des Moines. Hi.
Thanks for having me.
And this district went for Barack Obama twice, then it went for President Trump in 2016. Tell us more about the district.
The district covers 20 counties in the northeast quadrant of the state. Congressman Blum won in 2016 by about 8%. This has always been sort of considered a competitive race for Democrats in the past two election cycles. And they think this is setting up in this cycle for a very competitive race. And we've had some really interesting polling coming out just recently.
And Blum is a member of the House Freedom Caucus. He's been a supporter of President Trump. Let's listen to a recent ad where you see him playing basketball. He has been a high school basketball coach.
Teamwork gets results. It's a lesson Washington should learn. Let's stop fighting and start working together. Here's my plan. Pass pro-growth, pro-business policies to keep the jobs we have, create the jobs we need. Boost our economy with lower taxes and less red tape.
Kay, how is Blum positioning himself? How closely has he connected himself with President Trump?
Hip to hip, if you will. The thing that's interesting about Blum is he is harping on the tax cut package that passed Congress in December. The unemployment rate in Iowa just fell to 2.5%, sort of a historic low. Iowa has the second lowest unemployment rate of any state in the country. So he is trying to tie, you know, the economic tide, if you will, in Iowa to President Trump and to himself.
Even though many farmers in Iowa may be hurt by the tariffs that are part of President Trump's trade war.
Exactly. And the New York Times just did a poll in this district that wrapped up on Thursday night. And that poll found that a majority of the respondents back the North American Free Trade Agreement. And it was sort of a break even in terms of their attitude toward the tax cuts that passed Congress in December. Mm. So I guess if you look at this, Blum needs to energize his base of voters to come out in a non-presidential year. And to do that, he needs to ally himself with President Trump. He's doing that. That's what Iowa Republican voters want him to do.
The Democrat running in this race is Abby Finkenauer, who's been a state rep for two terms. Let's listen to an ad she released recently that shows her at home and the phone is ringing.
Growing up, we learned the union rep's name because when it showed up on caller ID, the other end of the line was Dad's next job. For too many Iowans today, the phone's not ringing. I'm running for Congress because Washington isn't doing enough for hardworking Iowans who need more opportunities.
You know, side note, this is the second ad this season that I've heard that includes a phone ringing. I wonder if they've done polling and figured out that that makes people pay attention to the ad, but we'll leave that aside. Tell us about Finkenauer.
Finkenauer cut her teeth as a staffer for the Joe Biden presidential campaign in 2008 here in Iowa. And as you can tell from that ad, she comes from a union household. Democrats have looked at this district with a bit of dismay over the past two election cycles because they were very worried about their slippage with union households. And so she is really trying to energize union households. She is also, if she's elected, she'd wind up being the second youngest woman to win a seat in Congress. And Nancy Pelosi directly donated to Finkenauer.
What's her record been like as a state rep?
She's a Democrat, loyal Democrat, has voted the Democratic line. And in terms of playing to that union base, the Iowa House of Representatives and state senator both led overwhelmingly by Republicans. They pushed through a repeal of collective bargaining law here in Iowa that she was a vocal critic of. So that stand that she took in the Iowa House of Representatives does resonate with union voters.
Interesting that you've got a district that's very competitive where you have basically a conservative Republican running against a liberal Democrat. It's not like these two people are right in the middle.
Right. And the other thing about this district is no party voters are actually the largest block of voters, about 188,000 of them. Democrats currently, as of the last report on September 1st, have a voter registration edge of about 23,000 over Republicans. Mm-hmm. So Democrats are hoping that voters who broke for Trump last time around will break back to the Democratic fold this time around.
So what are the polls saying?
Well, the New York Times just did a poll. It showed Finkenauer at 51% and Blum at 37%. Mm-hmm. There have been some other internal polls which seem to indicate the race being much closer than that. But things seem to be trending in a Democratic direction if you take sort of a compilation of all the polling data that you can sort of get your hands on.
That's O.K. Henderson, news director at Radio Iowa. Thank you.
Thank you.
Even when we're not in a presidential election year, it's always interesting to see what's happening in Iowa.
Always.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.